Since the show began almost 2 years ago, A Change of Tune has highlighted some of the best up-and-coming artists out of these West Virginia hills, with podcasty chats ranging from Jordan Andrew Jefferson to Heavyset Pawpaws, of the Dell to False Pterodactyl, and beyond. But those interviews have been a bit infrequent, and since West Virginia Day is coming up, not to mention A Change of Tune's second birthday, we thought we'd do something special. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews that range from Morgantown alt rockers and Parkersburg singer-songwriters to West Virginia music venues and regional artist management and beyond, all of which contribute to the state's wild and wonderful music scene. And today we are chatting with Fayetteville singer, songwriter, and storyteller Andrew Atkins. And boy, does he have some stories to tell. So let's just go ahead and get our WV music chat on, shall we? Bum 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 bum.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to 30 interviews of whatever. I forget what it's called.
Andrew Atkins, everyone. Andrew, I think you just introduced yourself and I introduced you, but why don't you do it again? Who are you and where are you from?
My name is Andrew Atkins. I'm from Fayetteville, West Virginia, a little utopia of West Virginia, and I make up songs for a living.
How did you get started in music?
I was in a band called Public Enemy.
The deepness of my eye roll could have been felt from 100 feet away.
I was Chuck D's first hype man until I got replaced by Flavor Flav. No, I've always loved music. My parents loved music. My dad was a big like Harry Chapin fan, and my mom was a huge Beatles fan. And I got to go see like Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton in concert and stuff like that. And I was just always kind of exposed to music, and I always just had I loved it, every part of it. Whether it was a record, whether it was an 8-track, whether it was Joe Cocker or Snoopy and Woodstock 8-track that I had.
Did you really have an 8-track?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you still
have
it?
Tells the Red Baron story. Oh, yeah. It was great. Joe Cocker, Janis Joplin, we had those 8-tracks, and then we had, like, some that I won't mention so I don't embarrass my parents.
Britney Spears?
They did. They were huge fans of Britney Spears back in the 80s.
In the 80s when she wasn't, like,
born yet,
probably. When you were younger, did you think that you were going to professionally get into music? I mean, were you playing music at all at that time?
I wasn't playing music at all. I was always obsessed with words and putting words together and making them rhyme. And it's like this brilliant puzzle. Like when you write a song, you literally create something out of nothing. Like it did not exist until you made it exist. And I was always obsessed by that. And words and the puzzle of putting them together. And I didn't really play the guitar. My parents bought me a guitar when I was like 12, and it was really hard. So it was under my bed, which I still have it. It's awesome.
Do you play it now?
I tried to play it. It's not a good guitar. which is why I didn't play it back then. It was very difficult to play. But I do have it strung up, and I'll pick it up and bang out a few chords on it.
So you had a guitar, you liked music.
I did.
But what did you do instead of playing professionally when you were younger?
Well, I was making up songs still. Like when I was 9 years old, I was making up songs. And my dad took us fishing on Summersville Lake, which I actually grew up in Summersville. And we were fishing on Summersville Lake, and we had lizards. And if you've ever fished with lizards, you hook them through their nose. And you cast them out, and then the fish eat them. But my dad didn't know how to do it very well. So every time I would cast out, the lizard would fly off and be free.
Aww.
But there was one lizard left, and he let me keep it. And so I sat in the back of the boat going into the docks, and I made up a song called The Last Lizard on the Wall.
Are you going to sing it?
No. No. It was awesome, though, I think. I don't know.
You have to ask your dad about
that. You know, a unique part about that is I sat in the back of the boat right beside the engine. And the noise of the engine being so loud, I actually sang that song out loud, but no one could hear it. And still to this day, a couple years later, not that many years later, I still do that. I still, when it's really noisy, when it's really super loud, that's when I write my songs, just like it was when I was nine. That constant hum or that constant noise, that's how I write. That's when I write my best stuff, is when I'm around that type of noise.
Do you think that's a common practice for songwriting?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I've never talked to other songwriters about how weird it is to write songs about lizards.
Why haven't you?
I don't know.
You've been songwriting for how many years now?
I've been writing songs
18
for,
or so.
Yeah, exactly. 7. No, I've been writing songs for a long time, and I think every songwriter has their own ritual or their own thing that helps them be creative. Some songwriters write like down on paper, and then I don't do that. I work it out in my head. And the reason I work it out in my head is because by the time I do work it out in my head, it's in there forever. And I never forget the song. But if I work it out on paper and write it down on paper, I'm always constantly looking at that paper and trying to remember the song. But if I work it out in my head, it's stuck in there forever.
So what was your first time performing live then? Did it take you a while to actually get up the courage to go out there with that little guitar?
It was college. I loved, I had a guitar and I loved music, but I loved girls and I loved football. So learning to play the guitar came much later in life when I was in college. When I was young, I was making up songs and listening to just obscene amounts of music every day. I was always that guy that, if you came over to my house on Saturday night, I was always like, listen to this song, listen to the words. Because to me, that was the most important part, you know. And so I was always obsessed with it. But then when I got into college and I wasn't able to play football anymore, there was a guy that lived in my dorm who had a guitar and played the guitar. And he would play these cover songs. And I'd be like, oh, I made this song up. And I would sing it to him, but he wasn't interested in playing it. So I decided, well, if he's not interested in playing the guitar, then I'm just going to learn how to play the guitar. My roommates in college played video games constantly, and I decided that every time they would play video games, I would play the guitar. It helped them out and me out because I helped them because they would stop playing Tecmo Bowl when I was trying to bang out 3 chords on a guitar. But I still got a little practice time in every day.
Yeah, and I'm sure they kind of, you know, got them out of the video gaming and maybe outside and enjoying the nature, the wilderness, right?
No.
No, okay. No. That was a hope.
No, I still didn't play out then because I was just so, I didn't know any cover songs. I just was making up songs I just didn't have the courage to. And I used to come to this party in Fayetteville, West Virginia, that was a big jam every year. And no one would ever play with me. And I was offended by that. And it hurt my feelings. So that gave me a complex where I wouldn't play out in front of people. And then years later, a gentleman by the name of Ben Cornet, who started the Wild Rumpus with me, he basically told me no one would play with me because I didn't know how to count to 4. And I didn't know what that meant. And he picked up a guitar and taught me. And I didn't realize that music had to have a time, rhythm, and meter. Because, well, number one, I always thought the words were the most important part. So I would change chords when the words needed them to, not when. So the first measure would have 29 beats in it, and the second measure would have 7 beats in it, you know, just whatever the song needed. And he kind of sat down and taught me how to do that, and then that just changed my whole world. I was like, holy moly, I just have to count to 4 and that's it. And then that's when I really, really, really started writing songs like pretty hardcore, like just every day constantly. Just, and then I'm like, whoa, this is, you know, what songs only have to be 3 minutes and 35 seconds long? This is easy. Because I'd been listening to Harry Chapin and people like that whose songs are 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes long, you know, and they're story songs. And I realized that I wasn't a story song writer. I wish I was. I mean, that I still listen to Eric Chapin all the time and other story songwriters. I love that stuff, but I'm not a story songwriter in that sense to where you start a story. You know, it's like reading a book only in a song. Yeah. Harry Chapin would do it, have a 12-minute song, and it was over. You were disappointed that it was over.
You wanted another chapter of the book, or you wanted a sequel.
Yeah, you
or
wanted
something.
To know. Yeah. And then he did that with Taxi. He actually did sequel, which is, in my opinion, better than Taxi. I love sequel. It's so great. But that Taxi was so loved that he ended up doing a sequel to it called Sequel. And you listen to him back to back. It's 14 minutes long, and you're just. It's like reading a book or watching a movie. It's so, so great. But once I figured out that wasn't the way I wrote songs, I got more into like, well, I mean, it took a while because I got in, you know, Bob Dylan and Townes Van Zandt and people like that who use 50 words to say one thing. So I was trying to write songs like that, and I'm just like, I'm not really that good at that either.
Yeah.
And then I heard like Guy Clark, who just recently passed away. And when I heard Guy Clark said everything you needed to say in 3 minutes and 12 seconds, and it just blew me away. And I was just like, I just became obsessed with John Prine, and because John Prine can do it too, you know, and John Prine and Guy Clark and even Chris Christopherson sing a 3-minute long song that change your life, you know. And then once I realized that that's kind of my writing style, or more my writing style, I wasn't trying to rob them. I was just like, that's how I write. And once I started doing that, I just started writing songs like crazy.
Now, but you didn't, prior to that, you know, you actually playing more live, you didn't really have any experience, professional experience, learning how to play guitar or learning how to songwrite.
No, I kind of just went from 0 to 100. I made up a song. It's called Molly Brown, which I always make fun of that song, but I really owe my entire career to that song. I made it up in 5 minutes, and we played it in front of a bunch of people, and by the end of the song, they were all singing along and all dancing, and I was like, this is great. So I went from playing in my basement to playing in front of people, and then we named our band, The Wild Rumpus, and we booked an opening gig with the Hackensaw Boys, and we went and did that, and it was terrible. I like to think that it wasn't. I always tell myself, because we brought in Chris Stockwell, a dobro player here in West Virginia, fantastic dobro player. We brought him in, and I brought in a banjo player. I didn't really know that he didn't know how to play the banjo until after the show, or during, I should say. But we did that, and then after that, all the guys in the band, Chris Stockwell was playing with someone else. The banjo player got married and moved to Portland, Oregon. The mandolin player got stage fright and didn't want to play in front of people. So there were some successful bands around Southern West Virginia that I called up, and they weren't playing all that much at the time, and I called them up. Alan Sizemore from a band called the Rust Kings. I was like, do you want to come be in my band for these 10 gigs that I have? And then Charlie Garvin. I was in another band called Shaver's Crossing. I asked him if he wanted to do it, and he wanted to play the guitar, so I had to learn how to play the mandolin. And then we played those 10 gigs, and they went well, so we booked 10 more. And then we decided to put out an album under my name, so we all went in the studio, and as we were recording that album, we kind of became a band. And next thing you know, I went from playing 10 shows to playing 100 shows, and I honestly didn't know how. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to play the mandolin. I didn't know how to play in front of hundreds of people.
And were you prepared for any of that?
No. I just faked it like a champ.
How was your first few shows when you were doing that? Were you trying to figure out like how you should look, how you should act?
Oh, no, I was wearing shorts. I was wearing gig shorts, and as all self-respecting musicians know, gig shorts are never an option.
Unless
you're an AC/DC. Or a drummer, maybe. If you're a drummer, you're excused. But if you're a front man, you don't wear shorts. And I was wearing shorts and a dress shirt, so it was even worse for me. I was wearing like my Sunday going to church and shirt and then shorts. And to me, honestly though, I thought it was great. Like I didn't know any different because I just always I've always been outgoing, and I've always been, you know, I don't have a problem with talking, as you know, and I don't have a problem with any of it. I thought it was great. Like, I was just like, whoo, this is great. But
you're getting,
you know,
paid. You're going traveling with your friends.
Yeah. I'm in a van with my buddies, and people are paying us to sing songs, and I loved it. But the other guys in the band who were professionals at one time and were still, they knew all the little ins and outs of this is not good. But I thought, like, if you asked me how the band was 10 years ago to how the band is now, I'd be like, oh, we're great. We're great.
Yeah.
But then I'll go back and watch videos of back then, and it's a little embarrassing, mostly because of the shorts. The gig shorts.
Yeah, shorts are not really flattering on anyone, to be honest. Like, even with or without music.
Grown men shouldn't wear shorts.
Yeah, I've told my boyfriend not to wear them. Not that I dictate what my boyfriend wears, but he also doesn't wear a sweater vest, and I wonder why. Because of me.
I'm wearing a sweater vest under here.
Under your heart?
Under my shirt. I have my sweater vest on.
It says Merle Fest.
It does. It's a Merle Fest sweater vest. It was a limited edition.
Well, getting back into the Wild Rumpus. So you were the one that really formed the Wild Rumpus then.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we were a bunch of raft guides in Fayetteville, and we played every Saturday night, and other raft guides would hang around and drink and dance and yell songs at us to play, and we did that. We knew like 20 songs, cover songs mostly, but that's not what I wanted to do. So I would write songs during that week, just so for that Saturday night I could throw them out. And I would really simplify my songwriting in the sense that I would make it to where other musicians could jump right in. I wouldn't put any real elaborate chord changes or anything, and I would just play straight, like, this is how you do it, this is how you do it. And then I could throw it at the band that Saturday night, and we would play it, and as long as I knew the words, everything was copacetic. And we did that, and then people started offering to pay us money to play, and I was like, what? You can get paid doing this? And
you know.
And then, you know, I just, so when we decided to start playing gigs, I just didn't want to be a cover band. I'm not bashing cover bands. That's not my thing, and I'm just not a fan of cover bands. So I just started writing songs like crazy, and we would do a 3-hour show and do all original songs. Some of them were better than others, but at least we weren't playing cover tunes. And we would throw in your obligatory cover tune every now and again.
Yeah, but you tried doing original music more, which is definitely something that I think West Virginia is still, one of the things is we do have a lot of cover bands here.
We do.
We do have a lot of good bands here that don't do covers, but we do have a lot of cover bands. And I understand that's easy.
But I think that's a problem everywhere, though. I think if we were doing this on somewhere else, public radio.
That's my favorite public radio station.
Yeah, me too. WW somewhere else radio. If we were doing this somewhere else, we would have the same problem. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we've been on tour in, say, like Bristol, Tennessee, and not very many people show up at our show, and they're like, oh, sorry, well, there's a real popular cover band playing down the street, and they're playing Wagon Wheel 7 times tonight, and everybody's going down there. Or even, we were in Connecticut one time, New London, Connecticut, and we had to compete with a Def Leppard tribute band. Oof. And we drove by the club going on the way to our club, and there was a line down the street, and we get in there and we're doing sound check, and we're like, man, what's going on down the street? And they're like, oh, it's blah, blah, blah. They're a Def Leppard cover band. They're so great. And no one showed up at our show because of that. So I think cover bands is an issue everywhere, not just here. Even though here it seems to be a lot.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, it's easy for the acts to do it. If they're starting out, they don't really know what to do with their sound or their appearance, and then they just think, oh, well, the cover song is the easiest thing. Then I can focus on other things.
Yeah, like working a job to make a paycheck, and then they just go blow some steam off on the weekend playing covers, I guess. I mean, I'm not telling people not to, even though you shouldn't. it's very difficult to make a living playing music when you're out there banging out original songs. And I understand that people want to go out to a bar and have fun and hear songs that they know. But guess what? If you go see an original band, eventually their songs will be that way as well. And I think that's a huge issue, is that people don't give bands a chance. And as you and I talked about earlier, in West Virginia, there's so many great bands. So many great bands right now. And the reason those great bands who are doing original stuff don't stay together is because it's hard to compete with Joe Q, Ride Sally Ride down the street, mm-hmm. banging out your favorite hits from the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And the thing is, though, is those songs from the 70s and 80s are classics because you've heard them a million times. Well, guess what? If you go see this other great band who has wonderful songs, those are going to be classics, you know, and you'll know those. When I used to tell people on stage that I wrote songs, like I'd be like, here's a song I wrote about blah, blah, blah. And then I would play it. And then I stopped saying that. I stopped telling people that I wrote the song. And it changed my whole career, because when you tell someone you wrote a song, for some reason, they immediately click into hyper judgment.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to judge your words, they're going to judge your melody, they're going to judge the way, just everything about it. And when you don't tell them, they're more open to it. And then after the show, they'll come up to you and be like, oh man, that one song that you were singing was so great. Who wrote that? And you'll be like, well, I wrote it. And then you'll be like, well, what about this one? Well, I wrote them. Well, I wrote all these songs. And then all of a sudden they're like, wow, like you're a good songwriter. I like your songs. I had a songwriter tell me one time, and this is actually the reason I stopped telling. It wasn't what happened when I stopped telling people that was unique and cool, and it actually progressed my career more. But the reason I stopped telling people that is because I had a songwriter tell me one time, who are you to dictate their listening experience? You know, don't tell me what I should be thinking when I'm listening to the song, because I want to have my own emotions. I want to have my own reaction. I want to interpret it for me. You know, I wrote a song about a father and son, and the son passed away, and it's a true story, and it's a kind of a famous West Virginia musician. His son passed, and I wrote a song about it, and I sing it. People interpret it as a love song between a man and a woman, which that's fine. But as I used to tell people, no, it's about this, this, and this, and this. And then some people just kind of toned out on the song to where they were like, well, that's too sad. It's not too sad if it's about a man and a woman. It has this romantic twist. But if I know it's about this, then it's too sad and I don't like the song.
Yeah.
So you just can't dictate someone's listening experience.
That's interesting, because I feel like the opposite is somewhat true when it comes to genres of music. So when it comes to... So for instance, like when I do interviews, I'll kind of ask the individual or the group. So people say that you are in this category of music. You are Americana or you are country. What are your thoughts on that? And of course they'll say, well, you know, I don't really consider it. I make music. I love music. They put that on me.
Right.
But for the listener though, I feel like sometimes they do need that kind of guidance as to how they should consider the music.
I guess you're right. I don't know if you're right. I mean,
No, you have to tell me if I'm right or not, Andrew.
I guess you're right, but I've had this conversation with several people about your generation of folks.
You mean the people that like Britney Spears?
The young people, yeah. who are jamming down to Oombop. Oh, wait, that was me.
But I didn't like Hanson. I didn't like Hanson. No.
Your generation of kids don't... I think they need less of a genre. And I may be wrong because I'm not part of your generation, so you can tell me if I'm wrong. But
so old.
I just see it happening more with people are just tired of genres. And you know, you and I had this discussion about country music. There's great, great country music out there. It's not on the radio. It's garbage about Budweiser and the back of pickup trucks and girls in tight blue jeans. It's misogynistic and it's dumbed down and terrible.
Amen.
But there is brilliant country music out there. You're just not hearing it on the radio. John Moreland, one of the greatest songwriters on the planet, Jason Isbell, Sturgill Simpson, you know, a lot of those people, even somebody like Leanne Womack or Brianna Lee, who's going to be on your show there.
On Mountain Stage, Mountain Stage. Well, you know, it's interesting that those people, the ones you just named, some of the ones you just named, like Jason Isbell or like Chris Stapleton, Sturgill Simpson, they're the ones that have floated to the top of this kind of pool of artists, but they still don't even get that much airplay on radio, traditional radio, you know?
No, you're right. But there's great pop music out there, too. There's great rap music out there, too. It's just not played on the radio. We're force-fed garbage. And, you know, what's the old payola scandal years and years ago where it was pay-to-play on the radio?
Oh, yeah.
It's still happening now. They busted it up, but it's still, you know, these big companies who have these money machines behind them are pushing these artists, and that's just what's happening. But I don't know if it's just me being optimistic, because I write country music. Like, when people ask me what kind of music I write, it pains me to say country music. But guess what? I'm from the mountains of West Virginia. That's what I write. But I write country music in the sense that, well, I'm from the country.
Yeah.
And I sing about truth of being from the country, and none of my songs have a tailgate or a Budweiser or misogynistic treatment of women in it. But guess what? My songs aren't really on the radio either. They are in some areas. You know, there are great public radio stations that play my music. There's great radio stations in other places that play my music, but it's not mainstream. It's still on a smaller scale. But I think, And like I said, maybe this is just me being optimistic, but I think the next generation coming up, and I say this because of what has destroyed the music industry of streaming. As you stream music, you're getting all different kinds of things, and you may hear a song that you're like, oh my God, I love that song. You don't care that it's not, doesn't fit in your wheelhouse, but that one song does. You may buy their album, and you may not like any other, but that one song is, you just love it. And I think there's a turn right now in the music business, because what is happening with Chris Stapleton, Jason Isbell, John Moreland, Sturgill Simpson, even Leanne Womack. I mean, I could name several more just off the top of my head, but what's happening is Jason Isbell having a number one record, Chris Stapleton having a number one record, Sturgill Simpson selling out every. That is a thing to the Nashville establishment that says we're starving for really good music. And that's not to say Sturgill and those guys don't have a big machine behind them, 30 Tigers.
they do.
They have a big, giant machine behind them.
Because it adds shine to whatever they're doing.
But they're great. Chris Stapleton, for example. Chris Stapleton is Chris Stapleton, whether he's with the Steel Drivers, whether he's with the Johnson Brothers, whether he's Chris Stapleton with his wife, whether it's just Chris Stapleton, he is what he is. You can't shine up that. And he refuses to be shined up. He is what he is. And it took him 15 years in Nashville to get one single cut. But you can't deny a talent like that. And I believe that there are a lot of talents like that, that have been suppressed by the Nashville machine or by the LA machine or whatever. But eventually it's going to rise to the top. And that's not saying everyone who's that talented is going to rise to the top, but at least it makes it easier for people like me to make a living playing music when people are paying attention to words and real, authentic music. And I think that we're starved for authentic music right now.
Well, we're seeing that in West Virginia, where people are coming out saying we want more music that sounds great, but also has a great message and talks about where we're from. And then we have bands like the Horse Traders or Ona or Quiet or anywhere else in the
state.
Which
are all three distinctly different bands. Yeah. And I think that's the best part of the music scene right now. And I've had this conversation with many people about the Wild Rumpus isn't really touring right now. And one of the reasons we're not touring is because we've been all over the country and met all kinds of people, and we've never met more talented people than right here in West Virginia. And we have this authenticity about our music that it's the Appalachian sound. And I believe that right now in quote-unquote Americana music, that's what they're after, that Americana or that Appalachian sound. And what you have is a lot of young kids with beards and flannel shirts and pants so tight you know what religion they are. And they sing these songs about Appalachia, or they try to be authentic and it's just fabricated.
Yeah.
You probably have to beep that.
No, I just kept thinking that like it went to one level and then I just kept thinking about it more and I was like, oh God. No, I totally agree though. I mean, you have not to, you know, be disparaging towards certain bands, but the Lumineers or Mumford and Sons, where, you know, people have fell in love with their original singles because of just how catchy they were.
Right.
And they had this shine about them, that sheen that made it seem like they were Appalachian or they were of like a certain variety of music, when in fact they really aren't, but they just have enough money pulled into the resources where it makes it sound like that.
I think I'm not defending the Lumineers, but I think the Lumineers to me are different than Mumford and Sons and other bands like that, because the Lumineers legitimately drove around in a van for 10 years before they hit. They worked at it.
Mm-hmm.
Other bands, they're pretty. They have their bangs covered over their eyes. They have their ironic mustache and their skinny leg pants and their suspenders. And they go from zero to world famous because they have the look and they have a banjo.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter that they can't play the banjo, but they have the look, they have the banjo, and they have a gigantic machine pushing them. And, you know, I think that the authenticity of the music that's coming out of West Virginia right now, whether it's the bands that are outperforming, whether it's the young kid banging out a couple original tunes at an open mic night, whether it's a dude on the front porch singing you a song he made up about his grandmother, the level of trueness in that song or that music, you can hear it and you can feel it. It's almost visceral, to where you just know that they mean what they say and they say what they mean. And it's a connection you have with that music, to where you have a moment with that song and you have an emotional connection with that song, to where with the radio, sure, we can listen to Britney Spears, but you don't have an emotional connection other than a memory. I mean, you may, when you get my age, you may hear a Britney Spears song and flashback. You may be in love with that time in your life, but you're not in love with Britney Spears, to where when you look at the timeless artists who are still around, who make great music, you know, you can't deny that, how authentic that is and how wonderful that is. Guy Clark, for example, who just passed away, when Guy Clark sings, you feel like he's just singing to you. When John Prine sings, it feels like he wrote that song to sing to you. You know, when those people sing, it's real. And I think that's what we have in Appalachia. And my goal in life is to promote that Appalachian sound. And I'm not just saying it's a distinct sound. It's almost like Americana, to where it's a generic term, because our rock and roll bands have that. You know, our heavy metal bands have that. We have heavy metal bands right here in Charleston doing great. We have rock and roll bands that are doing great. We have, you know, Quiet as a Vaudevillian,
mm-hmm.
you know, Eastern European gypsy band who are doing great. We have singer-songwriters who are doing great. We have blues bands that are doing great. But all of those have one common connection and one common thread, is that they sing from a very true place. And I think that's what West Virginia offers. And there are as many, if not more, brilliantly talented people right here in Appalachia and especially West Virginia.
Let's talk about one of those offerings in West Virginia, and that's Fayetteville, which is where you're based and where you, you know, perform and where you work, because you do so many things beyond making music.
I can't let my brain has to, it works all the time, and my hands need to work all the time, or I'll probably get in trouble of some sort.
And so that's why you do guitar making.
I do. I build guitars, banjos, mandolins, mainly acoustic guitars, is my specialty, and which once again goes back to Appalachia and how wonderful it is. I use a lot of wood from Appalachia that other people don't use, like walnut and maple and cherry and Osage orange. And so, I mean, I'll do your traditional spruce and rosewood or spruce and mahogany or whatever, but I try to use the woods from here in Appalachia because it's just, I personally think it sounds amazing.
Is that harder trying to get others to pick up those instruments?
It's hard. It's hard to convince them, but I don't even try to convince them anymore. I just hand it to them and let them play it. And you can't deny sound. When you're trying to buy a guitar and you hit it, you know it sounds good. So I don't try to sell them on it anymore. When people are like, what about this? What about that? I'm like, just come to my shop and play one. And they do. But, you know, I do custom orders, so I'll do your traditional dreadnought spruce mahogany guitar type thing. I do whatever, but when I'm building for myself or building for fun, I like to use alternative woods than what are traditional.
You mentioned before that one of your banjos you made for one of the guys from Langhorne Slim?
Yeah,
right?
David Moore is his name. I built him a banjo out of maple from here in West Virginia, and he tours with Langhorne Slim, plays the piano and the banjo. And he came down to Fayetteville. He fell in love with Fayetteville. He spent about a week. Fayetteville's a great place. If you've never been there, it's wonderful. We got all kinds of restaurants.
It's a little bit of heaven.
It really is. It's right on the New River Gorge, and it's just a great place. You know, a lot of young people because of the outdoor industry and a lot of great restaurants. And right now we have music venues that are blowing it up. I think they're doing great. We have several music venues that are bringing in original music. Like I've talked to some club owners who talk about how they want to eventually get to the point where they're not hiring cover bands at all. They just want to do all original music. And that's like 35th Star. They really push original music hardcore. It's a great room. They're bringing in local, regional, and national touring acts. The Grove, Secret Sandwich Society, they're bringing in some great acts.
And making great food in the process.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, Secret Sandwich Society is ridiculously good. The Grove is a cool hang, too, man. It's like this little groovy place right in the middle of Fayetteville. And they got big couches and a bunch of fancy schmancy beers all that. And then the Burrito Bar also is bringing in music Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
And I've
nights.
Never been there. Actually, I haven't been to 35th Star either.
They sell burritos.
What?
They do. The 35th Star, they sell pepperoni rolls.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
He makes them. They got one of those old convection ovens from Subway.
Yeah, yeah.
And he hand makes the pepperoni rolls. Ah, so good. So good.
I'm hungry now.
I am too.
I'm hungry now.
I am too.
Those are some of the forces making Fayetteville better. Can you talk about a little bit more about the Fayetteville music scene and how it's been growing over the years? Like, what are the factors involved in that?
I think it's growing. I think the music scene in West Virginia in its entirety are growing. In Fayetteville, what we have is a huge tourist industry. So it's easy. As a band, we used to joke that we were going on tour by not leaving Fayetteville, because you would play in front of a group of tourists. They would buy, you know, 20 of your CDs. And then the next Saturday night, you could play the same place, but play in front of a different group of tourists, and they would buy 20 CDs and so on and so forth. So it's a great place. And there's so many young people there because of the rafting and the mountain biking and the climbing and the zip lining and the hula hooping.
Is that a thing?
Oh, there's a bunch of hula hoopers there.
Is that professional?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's
you're
one,
kidding me.
There's
no.
One girl there. I can't think of her name right now. She just got she just made the electric trees or whatever, that big festival. She just got on their troupe, the Mad Hatter Hula Hoop Troupe.
What?
Yeah. I'll show you videos. We can listen to them over the radio.
That's crazy.
But yeah, and it's just, it's, and plus they're so active and outdoor people, and they just really like art, and they like art in every way. They like, I mean, the Grove, for example, they change artists every month, and they have an art opening every month. They completely change artists. They have live music, and we have a brewer. Nathan has a Bridge Brew Works there.
Yeah.
He's an artist. In making the beer, and it's just a really great town, and it's a super supportive town too. And it's like they love their own. And like when I first started out with the band, they were so supportive. And every time we had a CD release party, everybody was there. Now that I'm kind of doing my own thing and touring by myself, people stop me on the street and be like, "Oh, I love your album," or "I can't wait till your next album comes out." And you know, I'm theirs. They're protective of me and supportive of me, and they're that way with other musicians too. So it's just a great place. And like I said, there's 10 great restaurants in town,
which is great because yeah. You know, musicians are hungry.
Yeah,
I mean, all the time, and
there's always music. Like all the rafting companies have music too. They don't bring in big time acts, but they bring in local and regional acts. And
big enough though, Trampled by Turtles.
Yeah,
right?
Ace is bringing in. They have the Mountain Music Festival, Trampled by Turtles, mm-hmm. and Lotus, and last year was Del McCurry and Larry Keel and.
Was it Infamous String Dusters last year? Or
no,
was
that's
it
this year.
This year, okay.
Yeah, the Infamous String Dusters and Trampled by Turtles and Lotus and Galactica. And then there's some also local and regional talent there too. And what the Mountain Music Festival has been doing, which I think is really cool because that's Ace, and it's a whitewater rafting company, and they're kind of a campus. They're all to their own. But what they've done is 35th Star has they have Big Something, which is a huge band now in that little hippie jam band hula hooping scene. They play at the Glass sometimes, and everybody from Fayetteville drives over that. But they have Big Something, for example, and it'll be the Mountain Music Festival presents Big Something at the 35th Star. So the 35th Star will have a band, because Ace isn't open in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So to promote their festival, they will pay to have a band.
Smart.
At another local venue that is open in the winter. So it gives that local venue money for the winter and exposure. And also it gets people into that band who's going to be playing the festival.
Smart.
And then the Burrito Bar is the same way. They have the Mountain Music Festival presents Yum Yum Beast. And so people who've never heard of Yum Yum Beast can go to the Burrito Bar and be like, "Oh, this is great. Oh, they're going to be at Ace's Festival."
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's another thing that's helping. And, you know, some of the club owners may disagree with me, but from an outsider looking in, I think that's really helping the music scene too, because everybody's collectively working towards one goal, and that is to make Fayetteville a music destination.
Yeah, and I've been seeing that in Huntington. I've been seeing that in Fayetteville too, actually. Just if you scroll through social media, you'll just see all these bands, you know, showing that they're supporting one another, that they're going out to do shows, that they're touring with each other. The venues are getting involved. And different local organizations, and that makes the effort, because when you see that coalition of local art lovers coming together for the sake of West Virginia and West Virginia business and West Virginia art, that makes you want to be a part of that. And if you're not a part of it, it makes you feel like you're missing out on it, and then makes you want to be a part of it next time.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's why I'm super stoked about the West Virginia music scene right now. I think that if we can have the bands that are going right now, and I'm not just talking Huntington, Charleston, Fayetteville, more, I'm talking about all the bands in West Virginia that are doing original music, and they're really moving forward. And if they can stay together and we can make progress this way, the progress will be much faster with these group of people that are doing it right now, because they're the real deal. I mean, you can go listen to some of these bands, and you're not going to see a better band anywhere in the country. You know, if they break up next week,
we're screwed.
But, you know, I think that the music scene right now, and I'm a little older than you, so 20 years or so. So I've seen the music scenes. I've seen the ebb and flow of the music scene going. You know, when I first started coming around Fayetteville, it was the Red Star Rockets, which were great, and Mike Morningstar, which is a West Virginia legend. He should be in the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. You know, And Todd Burge was playing around, who's still wonderful and
still
playing
alive and kicking.
Yeah. You can't kill Todd Burge. It's impossible. Yeah. I mean, I used to go watch him all the time when I was younger around Fayetteville and stuff. I'm, you know, big fan. And he's, you know, as a songwriter in West Virginia, that's who you're first. Mike Morningstar.
Tim O'Brien, maybe too.
Well, Tim O'Brien, but I mean, you didn't see Tim O'Brien playing a rafting company. You know, at that time, you know, Tim was long gone in Colorado.
But, yeah.
So for me, it was Mike Morningstar was, you know, the way he wrote songs was just amazing. And Todd Burge as well. He was so prolific and wonderful. But as a West Virginia songwriter, when I was coming up, not even playing music, just listening to music, that's about the bands that were around here.
Yeah.
You know, and then you had Stark Raven, which was a little bit before my time, and Putnam County Pickers and Ron Soul's projects and stuff. And they were all great, but that was kind of a little bit before my time. But right now, what we have in West Virginia, and I'm not going to name bands because I don't want to offend anybody by leaving them out, but there's just so much good stuff going right now that you're not going to find out there anywhere else.
I can't stand days like this. I miss the rain and your kiss. Everything I do feels wrong. Days like this last so long.
What tips would you give to, I mean, you mentioned before not wearing shorts is a big thing that bands should not do. But what other tips would you give?
Gig shorts are never acceptable.
Just cross-stitch that into something. Get a tattoo of that so that you remind yourself
not
to do it.
If you wear shorts and play Wagon Wheel, give up. Go home and watch Netflix.
We're sorry if you actually do wear gig shorts and you do
I'm
play Wagon Wheel.
I'm not sorry. Those people hate me anyway.
Okay, so besides those two things, what other tips would you give then to the West Virginia musicians out there that are wanting to make a name for themselves and wanting to, you know, make their music heard?
Well, I think just taking it serious, being professional. Like, there's nothing worse than showing up to a gig unprepared. And I mean that on every level, like not, you know, have a set list. Don't stand on stage going, oh, what do you want to play next? You know, or showing up to a gig and asking the sound guy if they have an extra cable. Like, it's just be professional, be prepared, dress like a professional, act like a professional, treat the sound guy with respect, especially if you're opening. Like, if you're an opening act for a band, they're paying attention, you know, and you show up to open up for a band who's on a much higher level than you, and you're asking for cables, or you're wearing flip-flops and shorts, or you're standing on stage discussing what song you should play next, or you're sitting there talking to your band and not the audience, or, you know, they're not going to hire you again. You know, just be prepared. And to be honest with you, and I hope both parts of this make the interview, is I didn't know those things. And I'm not blaming you if you don't know those things, but you should find them out.
Yeah.
And there are people that will. And as you notice from this interview, I talk a lot. So ask me. I'll tell you.
You'd be a good mentor, Andrew.
I learned that stuff the hard way.
Yeah.
Like, the first time I showed up to a professional gig and I didn't have a cable, luckily the guy in my band had an extra one, and another guy in my band looked at me like, why would you show up to work without the proper tools? And just being a professional makes an impression on the sound guy, on the club owner, on the band you're opening for, on the other band you're playing with. I see that a lot in West Virginia, where bands will get together and play a show of like three or four bands. You know, and usually the bigger of those four bands usually closes out the night because they have a bigger fan base.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not saying they're much better than you. I'm just saying they're the more popular band, so they're closing. That more popular band, even though they may only be one step up from you guys, they're watching. They're paying attention. And if you show up to one of those shows and act unprofessional, they're going to take notice. And so is the club owner, and so is the booking agent, and so is the talent buyer, and so is the sound guy, and so is so are the people. Like, you would be amazed at how much the audience really pays attention. And there's some people who are just there to drink and have a good time or whatever, but there's other people there in the audience that are music lovers.
Yeah.
And they literally, I've heard this said, oh, they were a great band, but they played a 40-minute set and only played like 5 songs because they just sat there and talked about what song they should play. Just be prepared, be professional, and take it serious, because there's nothing worse, because I take it very serious, and it's still fun, don't get me wrong. I take it very serious because this is what I do for a living. So if you show up to open up for my band or for me and you're not taking it serious and you're just, it's just a goof on you, for you, then it offends me, because I work really, really hard to do this, and it's offensive. And
well, it's also part of a community. You know, if you are professional to elevate the whole scene, you can't do it by yourself. You can try to, but having everyone else, you know, step up and be prepared, it then shows that when you go out there, you can say, oh yeah, this is what West Virginia is. We we do our stuff. We play great music. And we have a good time.
Yeah, and it's absolutely, it's fun. Music is fun. Playing music is fun. It's amazing. But what else is fun is not having to stress out because you have some. We had an opener one time, and I won't mention any names, but we were at the V Club, and Old Crow Medicine Show hired us to have their after party. So the V Club was jam-packed. It was one in, one out. Like, no one else could fit in a V Club. And we had a band that showed up 10 minutes before they were supposed to play. They did a 25-minute sound check. They cussed the whole time on stage. They were supposed to play 45 minutes. They played an hour and 20 minutes because they stood around on stage tuning and figuring out what songs are going to play next. And a lot of people left because of that. Now, that band, we would never, ever hire them again to open up for us. And number two, that venue will never hire them again. And, I mean, they ruined their career in that one night, because you have a room full of 700 people and you're acting a fool and not prepared, and you ruin the flow of the evening and the party of the evening. That's rough, man. And they're not playing anymore. And I would solely think because of that, because they just really failed miserably at that night. So just be prepared, be professional, and be respectful. And don't wear shorts or flip-flops.
The title of your new record, your new solo release, is Wooden Heart. And it should be out by the time this interview comes out. Where did the name of the record come from?
I'm a woodworker, obviously. We talked about building guitars, and when I build guitars, I have scrap wood, and it's so beautiful I can't throw it away or burn it.
Yeah, waste not, whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah, so I just have a wood shop full of little tiny pieces of wood that I always save. And years ago, when my music career wasn't as going as well as it is now, a friend of mine had a baby, and I wanted to get them a gift, and I couldn't afford one, so I carved a heart out of cherry wood. And I gave it to them as a gift, and everybody loved it. And so everybody started asking me for it and for gifts or to buy them. So I started making them and selling them, and people were giving them away. And then I got sick a couple years back, and I couldn't tour with my band, and I couldn't work on guitars. I just didn't have the energy. So what I did to keep sane and to keep some income coming in, I just carved wooden hearts. And that goes another thing about Fayetteville and how supportive they are. People were buying wooden hearts like crazy just because they knew I was in a tough go. Excuse me. And then a girl texted me one day and asked me if I had any wooden hearts left. So I just dumped them out on a table and took a picture of them and sent it to her. And she goes, oh, that'd make a great album cover. So ever since she said that, wooden hearts has always kind of been in my head of being an album. And then when I put out my first solo album, it just didn't match. It's called The Long Way to Leaving. And or Wooden Heart just didn't fit it. And I don't even know if it fits this album, to be honest with you. It's just been hanging around so long that I decided to use it. And it kind of, you know, in some weird way, it just kind of defines, like, I love writing songs and I love creating stuff with wood.
Well, it sounds, you know, if you were to just take off like the word, it is heartfelt, especially because you're releasing this on June 11th. And that will be, that corresponds with the Brian Jennings family reunion in Fayetteville. Can you talk a little bit about that that event?
Brian Jennings was a dear friend of mine and everyone's. He was a well-loved person, great human being. He passed away 2 years ago of cancer, complications from the cancer. And there was a Facebook thing, which I'm not very Facebook savvy, but there was a Facebook thing that was like list 20 things or 21 things or something that people don't know about you. And Brian was a raft guide. He was a river manager. He was on the Olympic kayaking team. He was a ski teacher out in New Mexico. He was just a well-loved person. And on that list on Facebook, he listed that he knew so many people in so many different places that he wishes every year, once a year, he could get them all together. So, they would meet each other and know who, you know, so when they heard stories, they would know who they were. And, after he passed away, I promised his parents that I would make that happen. And we called it the friend reunion, but really Brian made people feel like family. So I call it the Brian Jennings family reunion, because when we all get together, it's family. And there are people coming from all over the world for this event. And, yeah. And there are songs on the album that Brian used to get up and sing with us, on stage. And, mostly it was me beatboxing and him freestyle rapping, or he would do some cover tune or whatever. And he had said to me that we were all original band. We do all originals. And every time he gets on stage, we do a cover. And he didn't want to do a cover. He wanted to do original songs. So I wrote two songs for him to sing with us when he did. And I finished them and I sent it to him. And he had said to me right before, he says, "I got that song." He said, "Next time you play," which was in June, he was like, "Next time you play at the Riverman," which is a rafting company there in Fayetteville, he said, I will do those songs. And unfortunately, he passed away before he got to do those songs. So since I'm putting those songs on the album, I thought it would be great to put it out at the Brian Jennings family reunion. Because one of the songs is called Growing Older, and it's literally a conversation that Brian and I had. And it's his words. I just made them rhyme and put a melody to it. And he was always positive. And so that song's kind of taken on a life of its own of being the anthem of that event. There's several bands. There are five or six bands that do that song. And they're going to record it. And we're going to put out an album of just
cover songs,
cover of my song that we wrote for Brian. And then when you buy it off iTunes, all the money goes to Brian's charity that we've created there in Fayetteville. So
that's really sweet.
He would do the same for me or anybody else. He was always, I remember when the Wild Rumpus first started, we called him our liaison to the people, because if we had a show, I sent Brian Jennings a text and he rolled in with 50 people. And I remember one time we were at the V Club in Huntington and we were shooting a music video, and I texted Brian and I said, "I need a lot of people for a music video shoot. We're at the V Club in Huntington." He said, "No problem." So we left early and we went down there, and there's a terrible snowstorm. Terrible snowstorm. We're in a tour van, so it took us like 5 hours to get to Huntington. And when we got there, everybody was, it was just the bartender and us and the film crew. And we were sitting there and they were like talking about, "Well, we should just shut it down. We'll get you guys a hotel room. no one's going to come. It's this blizzard. So I texted Brian and I said, don't risk it. It's terrible. And he texted back, nah, don't be silly. And about 20 minutes later, 50 people rolled in in the Brian Jennings Caravan, and we shot the whole music video that night at the V Club. And he was that's how we got our start. I don't wear shoes, and
I should mention that he's Andrew has taken off his shoes for this.
I don't wear shoes, ever really. But the big thing for the Wild Rumps became the shoe pile. And it was, everybody would take off their shoes and lay in front of our mic stand, my mic stand. There would just be a big pile of shoes. And I always made the comment that I love that I live in a place that it's someone's job at the end of the night to make sure you have the right shoes. Because it was true. And it became such a thing that we were in Manhattan at the Rodeo Bar in Manhattan, and a girl who lived in New York, from Kentucky, lived in New York, comes up, kicks her shoes off right in front of the mic stand. We're in New York City, and there's a pile of shoes in it. And Brian started that because he always wore flip-flops, and he couldn't dance in flip-flops. He was a great dancer. But it became such a respect thing for Brian that we would be playing a show, and there would be no shoe pile until Brian Jennings got there. And then Brian would walk in, and he would kick off his shoes right in front of the mic stand. And then the next thing you know, there was just a giant – which is funny. He was a professional kayaker, and our Brian Jennings family reunion T-shirts, which we sell for a donation and then donate the money to his charity. It's actually him kayaking down a giant pile of shoes. That's June 11th in Fayetteville, West Virginia.
That sounds like he was a good Fayetteville. He was a good West Virginian.
He represented West Virginia and Fayetteville and West Virginia as good, if not better, than anybody I've ever known. So he was a good liaison to the people that live outside of Appalachia.
Yeah, but I mean, we need more of those.
We do, and you know, I try to do that when I tour, even when the Wild Rumps tour, we always tour with a big, gigantic West Virginia flag, and we always hang it behind us. And, you know, I wear my little West Virginia state seal lapel pin. Our T-shirt, our second T-shirt we ever had, which I don't – if I had some, I'd have brought you one. It's the West Virginia state seal.
Yeah.
And in Latin, it says, shake your rumpus.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that was our
– Is there a word in Latin for rumpus?
We did as close as we could. We talked to some people that spoke Latin, and then we talked to the foremost authority on Latin, which is Google. And we got as close as we could.
Oh.
So
shake your rumpus.
So I mean, I try to do that when I'm out, and that's a really cool thing though. Like, it doesn't go unrecognized. And you know that because you do this, and you're a West Virginian, you work for Mountain Stage.
Yeah.
It doesn't go unnoticed, and I have people stop me all the time and thank me for representing West Virginia in a positive light, because you know we're not always represented in the most positive of light. So people who love West Virginia, which we are the most pride filled people in the country, for good and bad. People like that, and West Virginia has some negativity floating around, just like every state. But we have brilliant people here. We have beautiful people here. We have people who want to move forward, and we have people that want all these things. And it doesn't always get recognized, because it's always easier to recognize the lowest common denominator. And
Well, how do you see the West Virginia music scene like a year from now, 10 years from now?
Well, hopefully it'll just keep growing. I think that, and you know, that's contingent on whether bands stay together or continue to move forward. But I think the Appalachian sound is as identifiable as Delta blues or Piedmont blues or Chicago blues or bluegrass or New York jazz, or, you know, I really think that the Appalachian sound is that recognizable. We don't have a machine pushing that.
Yeah, we don't.
And we don't have... And when they're somebody kind of starts that machine, they're met with a couple things. Number one, not having enough money, and number two, they're met with hostility from people who are just a little standoffish, because we are proud people and we get a little standoffish, and sometimes people have great ideas that fail and we're a little skeptical. But I think that if we can continue on the path that we're on right now, moving forward with the music scene, I think West Virginia is a destination type music place. I mean, you look at Asheville. I love Asheville. I loved Asheville a lot more 10 years ago. You know, Knoxville. Knoxville's awesome. I loved it a lot more 10 years ago. Charlottesville, Virginia. Mm-hmm. You know, these places, New York City, Brooklyn, Nashville, these places, they get too big for their britches. And what you have is you have people that have a yearning to move somewhere where somebody uses the term britches as a grown man.
I say lollygag all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's okay.
It's like
old soul man, just old man.
the you know, why not West Virginia? You know, why not? We certainly have economic problems and we won't get into that, but why not recruit and use and but see, we don't even have to do that, because once we get that Appalachian sound out there to where people hear it and they're like, whoa, that's real.
Yeah.
Chris Stapleton is doing it right now. He's from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Stapleton is Chris Stapleton. That's what he is. He's authentic. He's real. Tyler Childers
is good enough, even though he's adopted son.
Yeah, I mean, he's from
West
Kentucky,
Virginia.
But you know, Sturgill Simpson's from mm-hmm. over in Kentucky.
Yeah.
You know, we have that here. And whether it's in rock and roll or whether it's in vaudevillian gypsy music or
quiet.
Whether it's in, yeah, or whether it's in, you know, me sitting on stage with a guitar singing about my feelings, or the kid who's banging out original songs at an open mic night, or a blues band, or a soul band, or a bluegrass band. We have this true sound, and it's as identifiable as any other genre of music. So if we can keep our spirits from being broken, which is a difficult task in the music business,
or just anything.
Yeah. And anything, when if we can continue to be optimistic and continue to move forward and continue to support, I think that's the biggest thing, is like, Why is Kenny Chesney selling out the Charleston Civic Center and Joe Q Public, awesomeness band from Huntington,
my favorite,
has got 20. Yeah, it's a great name for a band. He's got 20 people at the Boulevard Tavern.
Yeah. Well, it all feeds into the local thing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you support the local, then you're supporting something that could eventually get into the ears of millions of people. And then those people will then hear what true Appalachian, true West Virginia music is, and potentially come here. That's just a tourism thing.
And yeah, and that's another thing. If this becomes a music mecca for local and regional talent, national bands are going to want to come here too. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have even better music. So supporting local music begets supporting regional music, begets supporting national music, and then guess what? Those local bands are opening for regional bands, and then those local bands become regional bands, and then those regional bands become national bands, and then the local band that was the regional band now becomes a national band, and it's just this wonderful perpetual cycle of happiness if people support the arts. And I think this is key, and it's probably going to sound terrible, but you have an edit button right there. So if you're a venue, you can get known as having good music, no matter what the genre is. And what I mean by that is, somebody will say, who's playing at the Empty Glass tonight?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But you know it's going to be good because they have good music, or the Boulevard Tavern, or wherever else here in Charleston, or the 35th Star in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. They always have good music. Whether it's your genre or not, whether it's your cup of tea or not, you can bet one thing, it's good. And that, to me, is a hurdle that we need to get over in West Virginia, because these venues aren't getting, some venues aren't getting known as a place to have good music because you can show up at that venue and there'll be a terrible band there, a cover band of
Wagon Wheel, Boulder Crow Medicine Show.
Flip-flops and shorts. Playing Wagon Wheel. And those people that are listening to this, I do apologize. I'm not harshing on you. Joni is just mocking me behind the microphone.
I think it's so funny. But true. Could be true.
But what I mean is like, let's say Joe has a music venue who he books his cousin's Rat cover band in there twice a week. People aren't going to come there for music. And that's not helping. Yeah. So I think that if you, and it's not helping the supporters because they're not going to go, they're not going to support local music if they think that's what local music is.
It all builds up.
And the thing is in West Virginia, that's not what local music is. Local music right here. I've been all over this country playing music. I've opened for huge acts and I've played shows in front of 4 people and 10,000 people. And I'm telling you, from experience, that there's no more talent than right here in West, by God, Virginia. It's amazing. And from the musicianship to the songwriting to everything, we just need to get it to a fine point, hone it in a little bit, and get some support from folks who love music. And I think 10 years from now, West Virginia can be a huge destination music stop.
So, Andrew.
Yes.
Is there anything I forgot to ask you or something that you wanted to bring up in this interview that we just didn't get the chance to do?
I think that's pretty good. I mean, I think that if I can get anything across without sounding like a jerk.
So buy your CD.
Buy my CD because my kid needs braces on his legs.
Oh.
No, if I if you think that local music isn't good, you're not looking hard enough because it is. It is great, and I could give you a list of bands that are amazing. Friend me on Facebook, and I'll text you that list. And I'm not even on the list, which is weird. But there are so many great bands here, and so many great songwriters. And the songs that are being written right now out of West Virginia are amazing. Even if it's not your cup of tea, they're great. And we have wonderful, wonderful songwriters here, wonderful, wonderful musicians here. And just go out and support it. And as you support it, the more you support it, the better it's going to get. And the better it gets, the more you'll want to support it, and it'll just...
It's a cycle.
It's a cycle that'll be fantastic. And then just look at it this way. Eventually, you can look at your kids and be like, back when I was young, the music scene was even better. So just buy it. Buy their CDs. That's how we eat. You know, if you like a local band, throw them $10 for a CD. Wear their T-shirt, even though they were made in the back of a van. You know, buy their demo. Because if you like their songs and their demo stinks, well, if you buy their demo, they're going to have enough money to go record a real deal album, which you're going to love. So just support. We can't do this without you. I've played shows in my life where I look out in the audience and there's 25 people there and 24 of them are musicians who didn't have a gig that night.
Yeah.
You know, and that is awesome. But the thing is, if other people who don't play music were out supporting it, then those musicians would be having gigs and they wouldn't be at my show. You know, and I'm not saying it's a blanket statement because there are a lot of really supportive people in West Virginia as far as art and music goes, and I love every one of those people. Just, you know, you're with today's technology, you can just Netflix on Sunday. Come out on Friday and Saturday night or Thursday night or Tuesday night when a national touring band comes in to play and they need an extra stop. So they're doing it for super cheap. Come out and support that because then that band's going to be like, whoa, I want to come here on a Saturday night, you know? And they're going to want to get on Mountain Stage. They're going to want to, you know, you're going to have big acts being like, man, I got to try to get on Mountain Stage, or I got to go try to play Charleston, West Virginia again, or Huntington, West Virginia again. As long as you guys support it, the more you support it, the better and better and better it will get.
Andrew Adkins, Thank you.
Wooden Heart.
Andrew Adkins' newest release is Wooden Heart. You can find more information about him on andrewadkinswv.com. Hear more hashtag WV Music on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And for more West Virginia music chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/WVMusic. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.